Brexit means Brexit, and we're going to make a success of it.
We have got a cast iron assurance and a guarantee from the British government.
The particular problems around the Irish border are being used politically to try to frustrate Brexit.
Northern Ireland must leave the European Union on the same terms as the rest of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland would form part of our customs territory.
Hello and welcome to Brexit Republic, RTE's podcast on Brexit. I'm Tony Connolly, RTE's Europe editor at the EU summit in Brussels.
And I'm Sean Whelan, RTE's London correspondent in Westminster.
And I'm Colm O'Mungain, RTE's deputy foreign editor, also at that EU summit in Brussels. Each week, Brexit Republic assesses all the latest Brexit developments in Brussels, London and Dublin.
The backstop is dead. Long live a new solution for the island of Ireland. We'll bring you through how the deal was done. And depending on when you're listening to this, what are the chances of, to quote Boris Johnson, getting Brexit done and getting it through the House of Commons?
I'll be exploring how Boris Johnson cast the DUP overboard in search of a Brexit breakthrough and how he's been managing the numbers in Parliament.
And we'll walk through the key elements of what appears to have been a grand bargain struck thanks to the unlikely Brexit bromance, Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar. But first, Tony, last weekend things looked impossible, and they looked possible but very difficult. Then things went down to the wire. Just talk us through how the deal was finally got over the line.
Yes, Colm. Well, of course, the big landmark in this whole process was the meeting between Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar in Thornton Manor in Cheshire, as we reported on last week. And that set in motion a sequence of events. Now, the EU, obviously on the basis of that meeting, and then obviously on the basis of new proposals brought forward by the UK, started the negotiations. They were a lot more intense. They happened last Friday night and rolled into Saturday and Sunday. But again, a lot of the issues were very challenging. There were still big gaps on customs and consent, the two big key issues in this, how to manage customs on the island of Ireland and how to bring in the Northern Ireland Assembly to give them some role to try and get the DUP on board. Of course, by that stage, Boris Johnson had made a big decisive step. He accepted that there couldn't be a customs border on the island of Ireland, and that opened things up for a big compromise, a grand bargain, if you like, in which the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar could move on the consent issue and could also recognise that Northern Ireland would have to be in the UK's customs territory so that Northern Ireland could benefit from any future trade deals that the UK might strike. But things were pretty difficult last weekend, because on Sunday at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, gave member states an update. That was the EU27 ambassadors, or co-repair as it's called, on Sunday afternoon. And it was a fairly downbeat assessment. Essentially what he was saying was that the UK proposals were extremely complicated. How exactly would it work to have the UK, Northern Ireland in the UK's customs territory, legally speaking, but then in a de facto sense, Northern Ireland would be operating under the EU's rules and procedures on tariffs and rules of origin. Now, essentially, if in that scenario, any goods that were coming from Great Britain to Northern Ireland would be moving from one part of the UK's customs territory to another, but that other territory would be operating under different rules. So this is a very complex, unprecedented arrangement. It's never been done anywhere in the world. And once those goods entered Northern Ireland, you would have to know where they ended up. Did they end up in Northern Ireland itself, or did they cross the border into the EU's single market and by extension be able to flow around 27 or 26 other countries? So that would imply that you have to have some way of tracking where these goods end up, making sure that they're not going to end up over the border in the south of Ireland, unless there are ways of being sure they've paid the correct tariff, unless you're sure that they've complied with all of the EU regulatory demands and obligations. And essentially, Michel Barnier was telling member states that, this was very problematic in how it would actually function, both legally and logistically. Another problem cropped up in that meeting. What if you had an ingredient like sugar, which is shipped in fairly substantial quantities from Great Britain into Northern Ireland, but then that sugar went into, say, fizzy drinks or some other confectionery, and that product was then shipped across the border into Ireland and by extension the EU's single market? Because you have such a thing as rules of origin, you can only have a certain percentage of one ingredient in an overall product that can come from outside the EU. So these were headaches and obstacles that were cropping up. So in that sense, the mood on Sunday and going into Monday was fairly bleak, and obviously people needed to be focused on getting a text ready ahead of the EU's meeting and gathering of the leaders at the summit here on Thursday and Friday.
Sean, the London Times reporting today that this final push over the line had its genesis yesterday at about 6:30 a.m. Boris Johnson convened a meeting in Downing Street, and a call was made that they were going to risk going it without the DUP. How is it greeted kind of mid-morning when the news began to filter out? Was there surprise as there was here in Brussels, or were people expecting something?
Well, something had to give somewhere along the line in this whole process, and the talks have been ongoing with both the DUP and the European Research Group of conservative hardliners to try and maximise support around the ideas that Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar had reached a consensus on. Those talks had been back and forth with the DUP. They've been in and out of Downing Street quite a lot, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and it was reported at various times that they were on board, but then the DUP kept coming out and saying, no, we are not on board. And finally, when the early morning decision was made, the DUP issued their own early morning decision, and that was the end of it. They just could not come to an accord between those two positions. The question now becomes, how damaging has that been to Mr. Johnson's quest to get members of the European Research Group on side in his vote for Parliament? But you're right. Wednesday was effectively the time when it was decided, or Wednesday night, Thursday morning. That's it. The DUP are, to use that ghastly phrase, going under the bus in order that a deal gets through. And we started to see then the machinery cranking up. The Daily Telegraph, amongst others, leading the charge against the DUP, saying, who are these people? How can they think that they can hold up an entire nation's march out of the European Union with a deal? We need this deal more than we need the DUP. So all of the usual propaganda channels were being turned against the DUP.
Things Remainers were saying up to now, a day is a short time in politics. Has there been any evidence, I suppose, of Boris Johnson-backed triumphalism? Because there was movement on EU red lines. The withdrawal agreement was reopened, despite the fact that the EU said it wouldn't be reopened. And the backstop was removed, despite the fact that that wasn't being countenanced. So is there much evidence of hats being thrown aloft and we won in the UK?
Oh, for sure. And this is all part of the piece of trying to get the bandwagon moving and get as many people behind the vote that's going to be taking place tomorrow in the House of Commons. We are, of course, at a disadvantage having to record this on Friday. The big set piece is the one that's coming in the House of Commons on Saturday, when the numbers are going to fall one way or another. But you're right, they are very much marshalling the troops behind the Prime Minister and his agreement, and saying, look, Boris Johnson made progress where other people, namely Theresa May, didn't make progress. We've got a deal, and we've got all these things. As you say, we've got the Irish to move We got the backstop removed. And it's a great deal. That is the stock phrase that has been used by all of the ministers who came out both yesterday and today. A great deal, a cracking deal, a wonderful deal, etc., etc. Insert your glowing term of approbation here, please. Any support for the deal is now being flogged and flogged hard by all the cabinet ministers, by the chief whips. And then behind the scenes, they will, of course, be saying nice things about the deal to anybody who will listen to them, nasty things to people who don't want to listen, and whatever sort of inducements or blandishments they can offer to people as well to try and get as many people behind this deal as possible. They're looking for upwards of 58, maybe 60 people that they need to convince to get behind the deal. Both the ERG, and they were in again today, a few people like Bill Cash keeping their powder dry, saying we've had lots of interesting discussions but we haven't made a decision yet. Then you've got that group of Tory rebels. The obvious incentive to them is that the whip might get restored if they were to back this deal. And then they've got the they've got to try and tempt a serious group of Labour MPs, at least 20 of them, to cross the floor in defiance of their leader Jeremy Corbyn and vote for this deal. These are MPs who are in Leave voting constituencies. I gather they've been talking to around 40 of them in the hope that they might get around 20 of them to come across, but that hasn't happened previously. There's been a you know, small handfuls of Labour people have backed previous deals, but they need to get a substantial group across this time. And again, this bandwagon effect that's been generated about we've got a great deal, we've got a great result, that's part of the generating the hype to try and get as many people on board. One significant win that they have got from the unionist camp is David Trimble, Lord Trimble of Good Friday Agreement fame, who had been who'd written a very withering critique of the backstop previously for Policy Exchange, the Conservative-linked think tank. He has now come out today and said there's been great progress on this, the backstop is gone, and he would now support this agreement that Boris Johnson has reached. So that again will help the Prime Minister in his cause of trying to get people on board, particularly those members of the ERG who have been sympathetic to the DUP.
And in by way of a small world, to David Trimble's analysis was backed by the historian Paul Bew, whose son John Bew works as an advisor to Boris Johnson in Downing Street. But in all negotiations, there is an element of people viewing them as a zero-sum game, much as there is a celebration of a great deal for the UK in London, where you are, Sean. And Tony, here in Brussels, there was no sense of dejection or defeat in press conferences and off-the-record briefings. The line here was that because Boris Johnson was prepared to countenance regulatory checks on the Irish Sea and entry ports into Northern Ireland, that this gave the EU space to move on its red lines. But in effect, he moved first.
Yeah, well, you could probably say they both jumped together, but I think Boris Johnson had to jump further. But yeah, there was, as I say, this grand bargain. Boris Johnson accepted no customs border on the island of Ireland. Leo Varadkar accepted the issue of consent. And actually, the whole issue of consent is extremely interesting because it allowed Leo Varadkar, on the one hand, to appear statesmanlike. He could say, well, of course, democracy is important and the people of Northern Ireland should have a say in participating in these arrangements. But it also was the case that consent was wrapped up with a time limit. And of course, a time limit was always something the Irish government were furiously opposed to, and the EU supported them on that because they said, well, that's not really a backstop. But if you blend a time limit with consent, then it's an easier sell and it burnishes your democratic credentials. So what they were doing was to try and look at some mechanism for Stormont to have a say that didn't give the DUP a veto over either entering this or leaving it in 4 years or 8 years or whatever. So that was one of the big issues in the past days that they had to get over the line. The DUP wanted a voting mechanism in Stormont, which was largely the cross-community majority method, which effectively would give the DUP a veto because it would have to command the support of both communities, whereas the EU and the Irish government were pushing for a simple majority method, which would reflect the fact that it seems, at least, and this was a bit of a gamble by Dublin, that a majority of people in Northern Ireland, a majority of civil society, all the business and retail and manufacturing organisations were actually supportive of the backstop. So that was what they wanted. And of course, the EU detected right away when the UK proposals came forward on consent that the original UK proposals gave the DUP what they called an upfront unilateral veto. And not only was Dublin going to reject that, but the EU were going to reject that as well, because the whole point about the backstop was it provided legal certainty, but having a veto like this hanging over the operation of these arrangements, like a sword of Damocles, took away that legal certainty. Now, the way this broke down in the end was quite interesting, because the negotiators here in Brussels were working away on this issue. Eventually, on Wednesday morning, they got agreement on how the consent thing would work. And that would mean that the operation, or these new arrangements of Northern Ireland being in the UK's customs territory but operating the EU's customs rules, so essentially a customs border in the Irish Sea but with lots of exemptions, which we can talk about later, that arrangement would be voted on by the Northern Ireland Assembly 4 years after it came into effect. Now, if it was voted on a simple majority, which is the way it's going to happen, then if that simple majority said yes, we want to stay in these arrangements, then 4 years later you would get another vote. But if an analysis of that vote in Stormont showed that there was cross-community support for these arrangements, then the vote would come around not in 4 years' time, but in 8 years' time. So it was a way to try and thread in more stability in this arrangement. Now, all along, the DUP were resisting this. And at around lunchtime on Wednesday, I was contacted to say that things were looking good. The DUP were on board with the consent issue, and that was the last big obstacle holding things up. So while Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday morning there was an awful lot of negativity and secrecy surrounding the negotiations, and people saying, well, it's difficult but possible, or really difficult but possible, we might not have enough time, EU leaders were arriving, they still hadn't seen a text. At about lunchtime on Wednesday, RTE was able to report that two senior sources, and then it became four senior sources, had said that yes, the British negotiators have accepted that consent mechanism, and London is okay with it, and the DUP are okay with it. What happened next then was Arlene Foster, the DUP leader, sent out a tweet saying that RTE's reporting of this was nonsense, that there were still discussions ongoing. But my understanding of how things were moving at that point was that the text on consent and Stormont's involvement was stable and did not really move at all, apart from a tweak here or there between then and when Michel Barnier briefed people, EU ambassadors, on Wednesday night, just before the night before the European Council was due to convene. But obviously things weren't over the line at that point, and it was only the next morning, as Sean was illustrating there with this meeting at 6:30 in the morning. The outstanding issue by that time was VAT, that kind of took people by surprise a bit, but still a very sensitive issue. And it was only at that point that things were over the line, but clearly the DUP were either not really kept in the loop about what the negotiators in Brussels had agreed to, or were simply caught off guard by the loss of that veto, and were maybe grandstanding to keep the base electrified, or whatever. We still don't really know what was going on. But then by about 11:15 Brussels time, then it started to emerge that the deal had been done just in time for leaders to turn up and look at the text and then sign off on it.
Just to look at the text itself, or the new withdrawal agreement, people saying here that it's 95% or more the same as Theresa May's agreement, the crucial difference being the protocol on Ireland, aka the backstop, and some differences in the political declaration, the accompanying document, which is that the future relationship between the European Union and the United Kingdom. Sean, what's the most significant difference from your point of view? What jumped out yesterday when you were looking at it?
Well, it was the move from backstop to front stop, effectively, where you're changing from having an ultimate fallback position or safety net position to putting much more explicitly right up front what the situation in Northern Ireland is going to be. That was, I thought, the most interesting change that was brought about by that revised Irish protocol. Also, the way the consent issue was handled, and again, bringing back in all the stuff you've mentioned there about Lord Bew and his son working with David Trimble. Lord Bew had written earlier in the year saying how his experiences in the Good Friday talks had seen an Irish Taoiseach, Bertie Ahern, saw the need for a genuine compromise at the last minute and securing Ireland's most important interests, finishing the article saying it could be that a Fine Gael Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, himself something of a symbol of the new Irish Republic, may wish to emulate him over the coming days and weeks. So that was written back in January. So you could see that one coming from very far out, and the fact that that was coming in at the sort of last minute in the talks, that I found quite interesting as well.
VAT, Tony, how did VAT become such an issue? There was a floor, I think, of 15% is the EU stipulation on VAT. This was becoming an issue that was going to become of bother. What was the issue and how was it overcome?
Yeah, I mean, the main issue was that in order to underscore and protect the North-South economy, Northern Ireland would have to remain in the EU's VAT area. But that would mean you would have to have some kind of mechanism that catered for those goods going from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, because the UK would be in a different VAT area with different VAT rates and so on. If you're in the EU, then when you're selling goods across the border, you don't have to pay VAT up front. The VAT is handled later on by the end consumer. But that would be obviously not the case if Northern Ireland was outside the EU's VAT area, and that could be a disruptor to trade, because traders would have to pay VAT up front. That would have implications for their cash flow and so on. So that was an issue, but it's also an issue of sovereignty for governments. It was a very sensitive area for the UK. Now I don't have the absolute detail on this gospel, but we could maybe get into this next week when more detail comes out. But there was something to do with VAT on tampons, which is a very sensitive issue in the UK. There's a list of things that are exempt from VAT rates or higher VAT rates in the UK. There was a question about how that would be handled in this differential between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. There was a report in the Daily Telegraph about that, a somewhat unusual element to creep into the high political negotiations at the very last minute. But perhaps that's something we can look into again in a bit more detail next week.
In terms of the checks on the border, the regulatory checks, that's pretty self-explanatory. Things can be checked, but in terms of the customs and finding out what the destination of goods are coming into Northern Ireland and then for onward travel, do we know the detail of that yet, or is that just a principle at the moment?
Well, a lot of that is in principle, and the clever thing about this agreement is that you have the principle of Northern Ireland being subject to EU tariffs and controls and procedures, that is nailed down as legally operable. Where things are slightly different from the UK's point of view in terms of what they wanted out of these negotiations, things are less legally operable and less clear. So in other words, the UK wants you know, the absolute minimum of problems, bureaucratic problems for companies that are sending stuff from Great Britain over to Northern Ireland. Now, because there is a customs border at the port, at the point of entry into Northern Ireland, technically all goods would have to have customs declarations and pay the tariff and all of all that is required. They would want as much mitigation as possible. Now, what the EU have said is that we will have some automatic mitigations or automatic exemptions. So for example, if you're traveling back and forward with a suitcase, you're not subject to customs controls or duties. If you're moving house, you're not subject to controls or duties. But for all the other stuff, all of the other goods, industrial goods, agri-food products, whole categories could actually be enjoy exemptions or derogations, but that's going to be worked out in the future by the Joint Committee, which is this body that's set up in the, by the withdrawal agreement to manage the whole process of Brexit. And that committee will have to work out which of these goods actually are exempt from tariffs, which are exempt from checks and controls. How do you again ensure that these goods end up in Northern Ireland? And if they do only end up in Northern Ireland, how do you work out a rebate system if the EU tariff is higher than the UK tariff? All of that is going to be worked out in the future. So the UK is kind of signing up to this somewhat blind, because in the Joint Committee, it has to be done by consensus. So in effect, the EU has a veto over how generous these exemptions and mitigations are. But everything else for the EU side is legally operable. And that was Michel Barnier's mantra when he was explaining to member states how this thing's going to work. All of the stuff that benefits the EU's interests in this equation are more likely to be legally operable. The things that benefit the UK's interests are somewhat left open-ended and will have to be dealt with by the Joint Committee.
Sean, the Taoiseach had a press conference earlier, and one of the things he was asked about was if there was a plan B if the withdrawal agreement is voted down in the House of Commons. And Leo Varadkar told the reporters that plan B is no deal. Is that the sense of it in the UK? You talked about the bandwagon, but is voting the withdrawal agreement down seen as a direct route to no deal?
Well, I've just in the past couple of minutes got in the order paper for Saturday's business, and there are three things on it: a statement by the Prime Minister at 9:30, a motion to back the deal, and also a motion that says this House approves the withdrawal of the United Kingdom from the European Union under Article 50 on exit day without a withdrawal agreement. So this is a motion to withdraw from the European Union without a deal, a no-deal Brexit. But the expectation is that that would also be defeated, as previous indicative votes have suggested, that there's no majority or will in the Parliament to leave without a deal. And at that point, the Benn Act is presumed to kick in, that if the Prime Minister has not been able to secure either support for a deal or a no-deal exit from the European Union, then he's obliged to write to Donald Tusk by 11 p.m. tomorrow night requesting a 3-month extension to see what else can be done.
And an extension from this end, Tony, would involve the commitment to or plans for a referendum or a general election in order to get an extension of that length over the line, would it?
Yeah, I mean, the question of the extension from the summit angle is very interesting, because, you know, like everybody was exhausted on Thursday morning when this thing finally got over the line. And it wasn't just exhaustion at the sort of previous week's intensive negotiations and toing and froing. It was exhaustion after 3 years of Brexit chaos and back and forth. And that meant that when leaders endorsed the withdrawal agreement as revised, and of course they were very quick to say that we take our lead from Leo Varadkar on that one. Ireland's position on this is absolutely central. Once they had endorsed the withdrawal agreement, then the messaging was very carefully coordinated. No talk of extensions, but Jean-Claude Juncker even went out and said an extension is now not necessary. Now, the reason he said that was that the New Deal became suddenly a sacred thing, a thing that was so precious that they did not want to suddenly cast in a spanner by way of talking about an extension, because that would then perhaps diminish the prospects of the thing getting voted through in the House of Commons. Now, privately, of course, if it does get voted down, then for the same reason, the EU is not going to want to abandon the precious agreement that they've now forged with the UK. That is still going to be the only agreement that is out there. This is what they call now Withdrawal Agreement 2.0. Theresa May's was 1.0. Then you had the 1.2 version, which was Theresa May's deal with the Strasbourg joint instruments and legally binding clarifications. Now this is 2.0, and it's the last one that there's going to be. So everyone is really adamant that whatever way they handle the whole messaging around an extension, it has to be done in a way that absolutely preserves this agreement as the only show in town.
And even if 2.0 is voted down, Sean, nobody will be really dialing 999 immediately. Boris Johnson, in that case, gets to go to the country, and he still maintains his credentials as a person who has tried to see through the will of the people as per the 2016 referendum, with Parliament obstructing him. He has a deal now he can put to the people in the context of a general election and fight it on that basis. It's almost win-win from his point of view, isn't it?
It's almost win-win, except for one little snag, which is the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, which means he can't just call an election. As we know, he's tried, and he couldn't get the votes because they need to get two-thirds support. So he needs the Labour Party to come in on his side and say, yeah, let's have an election. But
and what are their conditions for the Labour Party?
Yeah, but what's in it for the Labour Party to help Boris Johnson, who has now got the wind at his back, who has the positioning that he's been lining up for the past couple of weeks, if not months, to be ready to fight a people versus parliament election. Now he
Well,
has
let me put it a different way, Sean. What's a good enough excuse for Labour as the main opposition party not to go to the country? What big ticket item do they need to get through in parliamentary business that says, no, not until this is done will we let you go to the country?
A referendum. That's the big ticket item. That is the only other big ticket item here, is to try and force him to put this to a referendum.
And put what to a referendum then? Has Labour clarified its position on what's been put in the referendum and what approach it would take in the event of that referendum?
Not as far as I know clarified. What they have been specifying is that they would negotiate a deal with Brussels and put that to a referendum vote of the people, with an option to either accept that deal or to revoke and remain in the European Union.
Do we know anything of amendments that are going to be proposed by former members, of people who were formerly in the Conservative Parliamentary Party or Labour tomorrow in London? You say you have the order paper there and you ran us through it. Do we know what amendments will be proposed in the course of the order of business tomorrow?
Not for tomorrow, but I gather the amendments are being held off until next week to see whether there is anything worth attaching an amendment to, because this is not a legislative vote tomorrow. This is just an assent to accepting this deal. There still would have to be legislation that would be, as we understand it, introduced on Monday, tabled on Monday for debate starting the following Monday. The Liberal Democrats have got an amendment to the Queen's Speech motion in, seeking to attach a referendum condition to any agreement that comes in. And they're looking at that as a fallback position, depending on what happens tomorrow in the parliamentary vote on the principles of this agreement that has been reached.
The European Parliament, Tony, still has to vote on this, and one would presume that they would back it, but everything's done, everything's not done till it's done. There are a couple of groups in the European Parliament who may want to offset or delay the loss of the UK members. It's probably not going to be enough of a dynamic to prevent the withdrawal agreement going through the European Parliament, but it's not done till it's done, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. The European Parliament has to ratify, and, you know, every now and again, the Parliament has popped up to say, hello, everybody. There isn't just one Parliament in town. There are two, and we have to be consulted, and we have to ratify this. And the Parliament has passed a number of key resolutions on Ireland, on the backstop, on the peace process and so on, that it's not going to want to overturn due to the revision of the withdrawal agreement. As far as I remember, there is a resolution which says there must be a backstop in the withdrawal agreement. We now, of course, don't have a backstop anymore. We've got something completely different. And as Sean was explaining, it's not a backstop anymore, because the backstop was the third option. It was the insurance policy. First option was a free trade agreement. Second option was alternative arrangements. If none of those worked, then you had this backstop kicking in. But because the free trade agreement that Theresa May was talking about was a very closely aligned free trade agreement between the UK and the EU, what Boris Johnson is looking at is something entirely different. So it probably wouldn't do the trick on the Irish border. So that's why they had to make this a direct destination for Northern Ireland. These arrangements would actually automatically kick in at the end of the transition. So that might be something the Parliament will have to just kind of tweak a little bit in terms of their messaging on this. But given that all 27 EU prime ministers and heads of government endorsed this withdrawal treaty in fairly short order, it seems fairly unlikely that the European Parliament would hold things up.
Okay, Sean, what's ahead in the next few days? Obviously a busy few days for you in Brexit land.
Yeah, well, of course, it's Saturday is the big one. We've got to find out exactly what's happening. Does this deal live or does it die? And if it dies, does Boris Johnson or somebody else write a letter seeking an extension? Or if it lives, what happens in the rest of the legislative process? And is the idea of a second referendum, is that alive or dead? And what's the state of play for the opposition, people who are opposed to Brexit happening at all? They haven't gone away, you know. They've been marshalling their forces and trying to get prepared for one last big push against Brexit happening again. So be prepared for a big clash in London.
Tony, the unanimity or consensus in Dublin amongst political parties has largely remained solid on this agreement so far, at least in terms of the initial reaction. But is this it for Brexit machinations in Brussels for the foreseeable future over the next couple of weeks, dare to dream?
Well, unfortunately not. I mean, everybody's going to be transfixed by what happens in Westminster. And then, of course, if the vote goes down in Westminster, you've got the whole Benn Act kicking in, and then the EU is going to have to respond to that. So the question is, can the EU respond without having to call another summit before the end of October? Does everybody have to traipse back to Brussels? If the deal is accepted in the House of Commons, then unfortunately we don't have a huge amount of time to kind of lie around and recover from 3 years of negotiations, because both sides have committed to start the free trade agreement negotiations pretty much immediately. Obviously Boris Johnson wants and thinks that those negotiations can conclude by the end of the transition, which is December 2020. Most people think that that's far too ambitious, so we are going to have to get into those negotiations fairly quickly.
All right, that's it for another edition of Brexit Republic. From me, Colm O'Mungon here in Brussels.
And from me, Sean Whelan here in London.
And from me, Tony Connolly, RT's Europe editor in Brussels. Thanks for listening, and a special thank you to Jack Good for his production and all-round editing skills.